to be astonished.
It's that time again.
Let's get started.
From the Clatsop County Historical Society, an adventure in history with Matt Burns and Alana Quila.
You should never be allowed to talk to people.
Some people without brains do an awful lot of talking.
And now, with today's adventure, it's Mac and Alana.
Good evening, and thank you for joining us on the last few days of March. Yes, it is almost April.
Spring break.
Yeah, spring break was lovely, of course. I always think it should be longer. My cousins in Canada take 2 weeks for spring break.
Wow.
And I feel like that's like a...
That's a long time.
It is, but it's, you know, more doable, and you need to like air out these kids. They're like sick and so many germs. And
now, see, 2 weeks, I could actually work with that, with a week of some kind of a outing, camping, a trip, vacation of some kind, and then a week to stay home and do stuff.
Yes.
Get stuff done.
That's why I'm saying it needs to be 2 weeks. 1 week is just like,
I could see that.
Can't get enough done in 1 week.
Although I suspect like you get more done in a week than most people get done in a month.
Oh, I do. I do pack it in.
So we're not having Mark on.
Not this week. No. Not for part three.
2 weeks. 2 weeks were enough. Oh. We're sick of him now.
Yep. You can listen to the podcast at some point.
Okay. So shall we get right to it?
Let's do it. This day in history.
So this day in history, these are things that happen tomorrow. March 30th, 1842. Ether is used as a anesthesiac for the first time by Dr. Crawford Long in Georgia.
Okay.
I like not being operated on like while I'm awake.
Exactly. I don't know that I'd want to be the first patient, but
that's true.
Obviously, yeah. I mean, I say obviously, but I don't, who knows? It must have worked.
Yeah. Well, right. He perfected it maybe after the first few. I don't know. Let's see. 1853, Vincent van Gogh is born.
Oh.
Fun fact.
Yeah.
He only sold one work while he was alive.
Oh my gosh, really?
Isn't that amazing? And what do they sell for now? Like $20 million?
Well, we wouldn't know because it's not in our budget. Yeah.
Oh, you don't have a couple in your house?
We could get the prints.
The prints, yes. The magnet.
Yeah.
How sad, though.
Yeah, I know.
Your stuff hits like, after you die.
You know you're good, right?
But... Yeah. So 1858, speaking of knowing you're good, Philadelphia inventor Hyman Lippmann gets a patent for the first pencil with an attached eraser.
Oh, I love that.
But years later, the U.S. Supreme Court erases the patent, ruling that combining two existing devices is unworthy of a patent.
Oh, interesting.
But it didn't do anything. Somebody else invented the pencil. Somebody else invented the eraser. You can't put them together and say you invented something.
Even though it's genius. And who buys separate erasers?
Exactly. So poor Hyman Lippmann.
I know, man. I would have been with you, buddy. Sorry.
1870, the 15th Amendment is adopted. It grants African-American men the right to vote. Yes. It's a start.
It's a start, yes. Yep.
That would have been the history highlight. But
yep, that's a good one.
It's a start. It's only a start. Didn't
still,
go far
still
enough.
Still working on it, yeah.
1939, Batman debuts in comics. Detective Comics.
Fun.
Like number 27 or something. 1971, Starbucks opens its first store in Seattle's Pike Place Market.
I've been to that original one.
So the original one had one employee.
Oh, my goodness.
A single employee. Isn't that amazing?
That is. Yeah. So my parents lived up there in the 80s, and they said Starbucks was the only coffee sold on all the ferries. So that's where they had drank it first, because it was the only option. And so it really became more popular because it was good. And then it was the only thing you could have.
That's a marketing genius.
It is, isn't it?
Only carry, or I bet they made some kind of a deal.
Yeah.
So it was 1,000 square foot commercial space. And you know where Starbucks come from is the name?
I don't.
It's from Moby Dick. It's the first mate.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I did not know that. Okay.
So they were big Moby Dick fans, and they had considered naming the business Pequod, which was the name of the ship.
Okay.
Better choice, Starbucks.
I think so. But I mean, who knows, right?
Yep.
Household names.
All right. Then 1981, President Reagan is shot.
Oh, yes.
I remember
the Brady
that.
Bill.
Yeah. And I remember that Saturday Live made fun of it. They had Eddie Murphy as Gumby getting shot.
Oh, no.
And they mocked all the news coverage over and over and over again. But our history highlight of the day, I think had the most impact on March 30th, 1867. U.S. Secretary of State William H. Seward signs a treaty with Russia to purchase Alaska for $7 million. It's about 2 cents on the acre.
Yay us.
And he got mocked repeatedly in the United States, in the press, in the Senate, and everything else. It was Seward's folly.
Before they knew all the oil worked. And yes.
Exactly. That worked out a little better than the pencil and eraser combo. Seward, good job.
Yeah, that was a good one.
So, did I miss anything?
You didn't, but you were having a debate with yourself about which was the top one. So what's your top two?
I was thinking Starbucks.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, because was there a million coffee shops everywhere before Starbucks and drive-thrus? And was it this nuts?
Well, and Starbucks and McDonald's have really honed in on that marketing of, you know, doing everything the same, right? I mean, that is kind of a marketing philosophy and sort of a business philosophy that isn't always duplicated either.
It was the McDonald's that you could have something familiar no matter where
you are. And it's the logo that you understand, not necessarily the words. So yeah, that's a big one too. Both are important.
So, and I also had a whole bunch more information on Starbucks.
For another show.
And that's what confused me, because I put that at the end and I was like, wait, was that the one I chose?
Yeah.
And then I realized it wasn't. It was just because I had a whole bunch of information.
Okay.
So, but actually, we want to talk today about the Astoria column.
Yes, let's do it.
Because we have the exhibit at the Heritage Museum, which is fantastic, and lots of interactives for kids. And it's the 100th anniversary of the column.
Yeah.
July 22nd, 1926 is when it was dedicated.
Oh my goodness. And there's something happening every month.
All the time. So always something going on.
Do you know what April? Oh, Max like, no, I don't know yet. Okay. There will be something fun in April.
Yes, of course.
Of course.
Rumor has it the Easter Bunny might be appearing.
Oh, that would be fun.
But we want to talk about how much time, when you go up there, you know, some people just sit in the parking lot, look at the sunset or the sunrise, look at the view. That's great. Some people buy a little glider and walk the 164 steps to the top and throw it off. That's great. But there's beautiful artwork on that thing.
Mm-hmm.
It is a giant piece of art.
I love it.
How often do we really read and pay attention to what's there?
Oh, never.
So that's what we're going to do today.
Okay.
We're going to go through what each section of the column is.
And then your interest is going to be so piqued that you're going to come check out the exhibit and see all this close up.
Yeah. So do you want to start us off or should I?
You go.
All right, because you don't want to pronounce his name. So first, we should give out a shout out to the artist, and I'm not going to pronounce his name right. I never do. Attilio Pasterla. He used what's called sgraffito, and I know that's a strange word, but it's on the Astoria column's exterior. This decorative technique, for which Pasterla was considered a master, involves the laying of multiple layers of other colors of material, often plaster or clay.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like cement or something. Then carving away portions of the surface to reveal the various colors below.
Oh, my goodness.
The initial lines that he used to carve the artwork were applied to the column using a series of cartoons. In this context, a cartoon refers to a design, drawing, or painting made by an artist as a model for the finished work. He made full-size cartoons of the column's mural on large sheets of paper, then transferred the images onto the column by blowing chalk through small holes outlining each of the figures. Isn't that crazy? So before he prepared the cartoons, he made an initial sketch of the column's design approximately. You can come see it because it used to hang in the city hall.
It's really tall.
And now it's hanging at the beginning of this exhibit. So come see it. This original drawing has been preserved and is on display at the front of the exhibits courtesy of the city of Astoria.
And all of this was done outside.
Yeah.
Wasn't pre-done and then plastered on.
You can't do it. So you got scaffolding, and that's why it wasn't done in time for July 22nd.
And
it was only about a third done. It wasn't actually finished until about October or September.
Oh, because it'd have to be dry. Okay. Yeah. Well, I'm even more impressed.
So each section, and this is what's written on the column, and we're going to kind of talk about what the artwork says.
Okay. So we're going to start with the first section, and it's titled Before the White Man Came. Attilio Pasterla depicts the pre-contact Pacific Northwest as devoid of humans. Though people had lived here since time immemorial, the Clatsop and Chinook flanked the south and north edges of the lower Columbia River. These complex societies flourished for millennia without intrusion from Europeans or their descendants.
Yeah, I like, and this is, you know, typical of history in 1926, but nothing happens till the white man gets here.
Right.
Yeah, there's no history here. So... we acknowledge and know better now.
Yes.
So the next one is Robert Gray in the ship Columbia in the Great River of the West, May 11th, 1792. On May 12, 1792, merchant sea captain Robert Gray successfully navigated his ship, the Columbia Redivia, into the river, now commonly known as the Columbia, the big one right out there. You folks all see it, becoming the first recorded Euro-American to do so. The name Columbia comes from Gray's ship, though this body of water carries many other names. And I'm not going to try to pronounce these. They're in our exhibit, but you know, there's what the Chinook called it, what different tribes, the Yakima. Basically, though, they all have different pronunciations, different words, but they all kind of translate as big river.
Which is very accurate.
Yeah, it makes sense. Among Europeans and Euro-Americans, Spanish charts originally identified the Columbia as El Rio de San Roque, the St. Roche River, a name given by explorer Bruno de Heceta in 1775 upon first sighting its mouth. New Englander Jonathan Carver's A New Map of North America from the latest discoveries, 1778, it's a bestseller, simply called it River of the West. On January 23rd, 1793, 7 months after Gray christened it the Columbia, eventual U.S. President Thomas Jefferson would write in a letter, "It would seem by the latest maps as if a river called Oregon interlocked with the Missouri."
There we go. So we're moving. Are we moving up the column?
We are.
Okay.
It begins at the bottom and works its way.
All right. So we're going to go up one more section. Gray finds an Indian village on the bank of the river. Now, Gray's encounter with the Chinook provides the first written account of contact between the Chinook and a Euro-American. Chinook oral tradition, however, records much earlier interactions. In an 1894 interview with noted anthropologist Franz Boas, a Chinook informant described an incident, probably dating to the mid-1700s, of a Clatsop woman sighting a ship that she initially perceived as a whale with two spruce trees attached. "Oh, behold, it is not a whale. Behold, it is a whale. Behold, a monster."
Because people start climbing out of it.
Yeah, that would be a little terrifying. And it's floating.
And especially if you haven't seen something like a ship.
So this monster would wreck upon the Clatsop shoreline, be stripped of its goods, and the two surviving crew members were then enslaved by the local folks. Both Pastorla's sketch and finished mural depict objects of trade between the indigenous communities and Europeans, salmon and furs for goods such as pottery and a hand mirror. Additional items included beads, blankets, firearms, and alcohol. Even with the introduction of European items, initially the Clatsop and Chinook continued to control the terms of trade along the lower Columbia River. These goods introduced new wealth to the region and disastrously through contact disease.
Decimated.
Right.
Lieutenant Broughton names Mount Hood October 1792. I like Broughton. Okay. He's a pretty amazing explorer. In October 1792, British Captain George Vancouver attempted to enter the Columbia River using a chart given him by Captain Robert Gray. That was nice. He should have just used GPS. though Vancouver's ship proved too big to navigate into the river's mouth, two smaller vessels commanded by British Royal Navy Lieutenant William Broughton successfully traversed the Columbia River Bar. There was no Captain Flavelle. On a mission of exploration rather than trade, Broughton traveled approximately 100 miles upriver, naming many of the sites he encountered along the way. Huh. Names still in usage today include Puget Island, named for fellow officer Peter Puget. Yeah. I like Peter Puget, too. Yes. That's a fun name. It's kind of like a Marvel superhero's name.
Yeah, it does.
On October 26th, Mount Hood, named for British Admiral Lord Samuel Hood on October 29th, and Point Vancouver in present-day Vancouver, Washington, named for his commanding officer on October 30th. Always good to kiss up.
And name it after men.
Yeah, these sites, of course. These sites all had existing names. One such name for Mount Hood, Waist, and I'm not going to say these right, come from a Klickitat myth in which Waist and his brother Paolo, Mount Adams, compete for the love of Lewitt, Mount St. Helens.
I love that.
I do too.
So again, we're going to go up one more. The Lewis and Clark Expedition Crossing the Mountains. President Thomas Jefferson commissioned the Core Discovery in 1803 with the goals to explore the Louisiana Purchase, establish trade with tribes, record and observe plant and animal life, and record American presence on the land, solidifying America's claim. Jefferson chose Meriwether Lewis as the leader, who in turn recruited William Clark to join him. On their westward journey, 1804 to 1805, the Corps of Discovery confronted inclement weather, near starvation, and great tribulation in the Bitterroot Mountains, part of the Rockies. Of the approximately 45 people who made the venture west as part of this expedition, this portion of the mural focuses upon Shoshone guide and interpreter Sacagawea, pictured with her infant son, John Baptiste Charbonneau, on her back.
Way to go.
Yeah, treated as a minor character in most 19th century accountings of the voyage, suffragists in the early 1900s embraced her as a feminist icon. For the 1905 Lewis and Clark Exposition in Portland, Oregon, the National American Women's Suffrage Association commissioned sculptor Alice Cooper to cast a bronze statue of the Shoshone Guide that now stands in the city's Washington Park. Believed to be the first of many Sacagawea sculptures now dotting the Lewis and Clark National Historic Trail, it bears the inscription, erected by the women of the United States in memory of the only woman in the Lewis and Clark expedition and in honor of the pioneer mother of Oregon.
I like that.
Yes.
All right. Indians greet the explorers is the next section. Throughout their travels, the Lewis and Clark expedition received aid from many of the Native American groups that they encountered. That always amazes me that they could have just been wiped out in a heartbeat. So it really is the grace of everyone they encountered. This would remain true during their time among the Clatsop and Chinook. Locally, members of the expedition received necessary foodstuffs and trade, as well as vital geographic information that would ultimately determine where they established their winter camp. At the time of their arrival, the journals of Lewis and Clark recorded an estimated 16,000 Chinookan-speaking people in the region, mostly in smaller bands and villages. The Clatsop, for example, were believed to have a population of around 400 people. These numbers would have been seriously reduced from those of pre-contact by smallpox epidemics in the 1770s and again in 1801. So again, picture that, 16,000, and that's decimated.
Right.
So how many were there before that?
Oh, man. Yeah, and it couldn't have been that far because they wouldn't have traveled that far inland either, right, at that point when they were doing their...
You know, their trading network went pretty far. But
the trading network,
yeah,
okay.
But I don't know how far upriver.
Like inland.
Yeah, and it went up and down the coast. I mean, everything kind of had to go through them here, and they were apparently excellent middlemen.
Right.
In terms of business.
Huh. Okay, so moving on. Lewis and Clark reached the Pacific. On November 7th, 1805, believing they'd finally reached the Pacific Ocean, William Clark recorded in his journal, "Ocean in view. Oh, the joy." In actuality, they were viewing the Columbia River estuary and were still about 20 miles from the coast. Severe winter storms would slow their progress and ultimately bog them down for a week at a site that Clark named Dismal Niche. The first part of their party reached the ocean on November 15th, 1805.
And Rex Zeke, local authority and expert, has written an amazing book called Ocean in View about this and about their time at the mouth of the Columbia. It's an amazing thing. Definitely should buy it and read it. Or if you hear him speaking, he just spoke back in December for the Historical Society. Amazing presentation.
Oh, how exciting.
A little commercial.
Interesting.
There. Okay, so the next one up, they obtain salt by boiling seawater. After killing dozens of elk, the Corps of Discovery members needed to preserve their food for the winter and the return journey. Lewis and Clark dispatched a patrol to the seacoast to boil seawater, extracting the salt to preserve the meat at Fort Clatsop. In 1900, I'm not going to pronounce her name, so it's Jenny Michelle, a Clatsop woman renowned for her weaving skills, identified the location for members of the Oregon Historical Society. Though born a decade after the Lewis and Clark party wintered at Fort Clatsop, she recalled the site as one where her father described seeing white men boiling water. The Columbia River Historical Expedition and the Astoria Founders Celebration included a visit to and dedication ceremonies at the Salt Works, or Salt Kern, the day prior to that of the Astoria Column. So when they dedicated the column, they also dedicated the Salt Works, and they also dedicated the Doughboy Monument.
Oh, did
the bathrooms,
they?
Yes.
All at the same time.
Yeah.
Okay, moving up. Fort Clatsop established December 1805. To build Fort Clatsop, the Corps of Discovery spent nearly 4 weeks felling trees, splitting boards, and building their winter encampment on the banks of the Lewis and Clark River. The fort was the first U.S. Army post in the Pacific Northwest and was occupied from December 1805 to April 1806. The depiction of the fort in the original sketch and on the column differs significantly from the floor plan Clark drew in his journal. Pasturla had a reputation for pursuing realism, if at times romanticized, with his art, even venturing to see the windswept trees near Seaside firsthand for use in the salt work scene. Here, he seemingly chose artistic license over faithful rendering.
Yes.
But it is art, right?
Exactly. I mean,
it is art.
Fort Clatsop is completed, is the next section. The Lewis and Clark expedition moved into Fort Clatsop on Christmas Day, 1805. The party faced a harsh, rainy winter, seemingly made worse by cultural misunderstandings and an unfamiliarity with weather conditions typical of the region. In efforts to improve their food supplies and pass the time, hunting parties sought out elk and deer, while other members of the expedition made candles, moccasins, and leather pantaloons for their return journey.
In other words, they were not dressed appropriately.
Oh, they're almost naked when they're here at first because their stuff is all just deteriorated from exposure and it's just like falling off them.
And it doesn't get warmer and it doesn't get drier.
One more reason I'm glad we live in today.
Today, exactly.
We have nice clothes, warm showers, nice cars.
All the things. Okay. Indian fishing and boat building industry. The Chinook and Clatsop are masterful craftsmen of dugout canoes. These large, sleek vessels can range in length from 15 to 50 feet and are designed for travel through rough, choppy waters of the Columbia River and Pacific Ocean. Both Lewis and Clark admired the Chinook and Clatsop produced canoes, writing extensively about the boats in their journals. I have seen the natives near the coast riding waves in these canoes with safety and apparently without concern, where I should have thought it impossible for any vessel of the same size to live a minute. A person would suppose that the forming of a large canoe with an instrument like this was the work of several years, but these people make them in a few weeks. Mm-hmm. They prize their canoes very highly. We have been anxious to obtain some of them for our journey up the river, but have not been able to obtain one yet from the natives in this neighborhood. And that was Meriwether Lewis in February of 1806. Unable to acquire that desired boat, Lewis commanded his men to steal one from the Clatsop, justifying his decision as retaliation for six elk that had previously been taken and for which Clatsop headman Cobbleway had already made amends.
Nice. Ugh. Excellent way to leave the community here.
At least we document it.
So the next section is Astor Overland Party leaving St. Louis. So we've moved on from Lewis and Clark. Now we're on to the Astor Party. John Jacob Astor was a German immigrant and self-made man who made his fortune in the fur industry. He began by exporting furs to Europe, but dreamed of establishing a Western outpost to serve the fast-growing Chinese fur market. He started the Pacific Fur Company and sent two parties to build the trading post, one overland and one on the ship Tonquin. In 1810, Astor dispatched the Overland Party from St. Louis under Wilson Price Hunt, a company employee, and it was a terrible decision. There's so many other people in that party that should have been in charge because he wasn't an outdoorsman.
Uh-oh.
The expedition reached Council Bluffs on the Missouri River and then set out on horseback across the plains via the Platte River in July of 1811.
Okay. Tonquin sails from New York September 8th, 1810. Bound for the mouth of the Columbia, the Tonquin sailed from New York City in September on September 8th, 1810, equipped with a full crew, Pacific Fur Company employees, and supplies to establish Astor's fur trading post on the Pacific coast. The boat journeyed south around Cape Horn. The Tonquin's contentious captain, Jonathan Thorne, would repeatedly run afoul of those hired for the Pacific Fur Company, nearly abandoning a group of them in the Falkland Islands. Pasturla was well acquainted with this, with using his adopted home of New York City as an artistic subject, both small and grand. His individual oil paintings included urban scenes and pieces such as the New York Harbor and the Brooklyn Bridge. Between 1934 and 36, Pasturla completed extensive mural work in the New York County Courthouse, now the New York Supreme Court. The court's rotunda with a 200-foot circumference features a massive mural titled Law Through the Ages. In an upstairs jury room, Pasturla, along with three other artists, created nine murals portraying the city in the 1930s.
He's a pretty amazing artist because when I first got acquainted with the column, associated with the column, I kind of Googled him and looked at a lot of his artwork, and it's pretty amazing. So the next section is Tonquin arrives at mouth of Columbia's spring of 1811. The Tonquin spent 6 months at sea with a 2 week stopover in the Hawaiian Islands. There they traded for livestock and other necessary supplies while also contracting with 25 native Hawaiians to work both on the ship and at the fur trading post. On March 1st, 1811, the Tonkin finally arrived at the entrance to the Columbia River, ignoring protests from his crew and shipmates as well as the conditions of the Columbia River. Captain Thorne sent out men four times to sound the channel. It didn't go well. Eight drowned in the effort, including the ship's first officer, beloved first officer, I should say, and two of the recently contracted Hawaiians. Which is why we have like Waikiki Beach across the river.
Is it really?
Yeah.
That's why.
Yeah, that's where,
okay. Well, that's sad.
It is.
Okay. So Fort Astoria is built. The crew of the Tonkin built Fort Astoria on the south shore of the Columbia River, 7 miles from the mouth. It was a daunting task. The hillside was thick with timber, and the crew members were both inexperienced and ill-equipped to undertake such a build. After much work, far too many accidents, and rumblings of abandonment, eventually the land was cleared and the initial structure established. Astoria became the Pacific Fur Company's depot for collecting inland furs, particularly beaver pelts. The Northwest Company, a British firm, bought the fort, and it was renamed Fort George during the War of 1812. The fort remained a mainstay in British fur trading until the 1840s.
Okay, so during the Astoria Bicentennial in 2011, I tried desperately, but nobody listened to me. It was never called Fort Astoria.
Oh.
So I've given up on that battle, but the Astorians never referred to it as Fort Astoria. It was referred to as Fort George when that happened.
Right.
But it was just a simple little stockade. They weren't soldiers. They were fur traders. All right. We're going to run out of time, so we're going to kind of gloss through a few of these.
Yeah.
The next section was Overlanders Cross the Divide, led by Wilson Price Hunt. And it talks about, in that section, of course, is all of the horrible things that happened to that overland group, where everything that went right for Lewis and Clark, everything went wrong for the Astor Party under Wilson Price Hunt. The destruction of the Tonkin, summer of 1811, of course, it goes north to Alaska to make a deal with the Russians, and it doesn't go well with Captain Thorne, and the Tonkin is blown up, and it's not coming back.
Oh, man. Next is the first overland Astorians arrived. So after 18 months venturing west, most of Wilson Price Hunt's expedition reached Astoria in February of 1812. Of the 62 members in this party, only two had died in the challenging trip.
Then we've got the arrival of the lost overlanders. Those were other people from the group that come in kind of in ones and twos, and it doesn't, again, go well for them. The transfer of Astoria to the Northwest Company during the War of 1812. That happens October 1813 when the Northwest Company purchases the place. The U.S. ship Ontario flying the American flag 1818. This is the Treaty of Ghent 1814 that ends the War of 1812 and ties into that a little bit. And then we've got the coming of the pioneers 1837 to 48. So suddenly now we're extending the time a bit.
Right.
Instead of these little instances. And this is as you know, the British and the Americans are trying to decide who runs this area. We talk a little bit in that section about Manifest Destiny. But then because the whole thing was paid for, or the idea of Ralph Budd, the Great Northern Railroad, we end at the very top of the column with...
The railway arrives in 1893. Can you hear the train?
Choo-choo, choo-choo. Choo-choo. Yeah.
So that's at the very end, and it really sums up the story of the Astoria column.
Or you could just go up there and read it yourself.
Right.
And interpret the artwork.
Yes. But you if you come to the Heritage Museum,
you can see it up close.
You see it up close, and you can read all of these and a little bit more in depth, too. So pretty fascinating exhibit at the museum right now.
I would be remiss if I didn't give a shout out to the amazing curator of the Historical Society, Dr.
Yes.
Chelsea Vaughn, and the facilities manager, Matt Powers. Other people were involved, but let's face it, we know the two of them were here till midnight every night.
Beautiful.
Putting the exhibit
very
together.
Very well put together.
So go make some history. We'll catch you next week. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for joining us for An Adventure in History. An Adventure in History is created and produced by the Clatsop County Historical Society and brought to you by KMUN.
This is KMUN Astoria, KTCB Tillamook, and streaming live at KMUN.org.
But wait, there's more. Visit the KMUN website and find our broadcast streaming live, local news stories, podcasts, our show schedule, the community calendar, and more. Find out how to become a member, volunteer, or submit a radio class application. Learn about the Board of Directors and the Community Advisory Board, all conveniently located just for you at KMUN.org.